This is a podcast from the Refugee Study Centre. To learn more about our work, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Thanks everyone for coming out. A miserable day like this. It really is pretty awful. My Italian co-presenter has just had all our worst fears confirmed about the English weather. So we'll try and brighten things up in here. How many of you have law backgrounds or know anything about law? A few. How many of you have ever heard of this case, Sardi? A few people because it's okay. Obviously, some of you may never have heard of this case. So I'm talking about a case you've never heard of, and I'm saying what's changed since this case. So I'm going to do a little bit of work explaining a bit about the case, which was decided about 2008. But at first, the issues that it looked at, because the European Court of Human Rights is a little bit slow, you may know. The issue it first looked at was a policy introduced 2001, British government 2001, to detain asylum seekers, to process asylum claims. And it reviewed, and the European Court of Human Rights reviewed that policy in 2008, and upheld it. What I want to do really is just look at how things have changed in practice since the facts that were put to the European Court in Sardi, since those facts in 2001, and whether we can see that things on the ground have changed in such a way that perhaps Sardi doesn't really apply anymore. It's not being properly implemented, and that there are some kind of, there's a need for it to be looked at again. Because the most basic question in detention of anyone is there a legal basis for the detention? And for much of the detention that's going on of asylum seekers, that this Sardi decision formed a basis on which detention that's administrative to process a claim could take place. So, Sardi then. Well, come back to Sardi. UK powers to detain, first of all, briefly, very small writing, but essentially when Parliament created the power to detain immigrants, it did so in extremely broad terms. It basically said you can detain an immigrant if there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that you might remove them from the country. Not that you will remove them, but that you might remove them. Notice it didn't impose any time limits on that detention. So it's still the case in Britain now that detention is potentially unlimited. However, the Lord Wolfe, in a famous case back in 1984, said that Parliament can't possibly have meant that you could detain someone for life just because they're an immigrant that you would like to remove from the country. So Lord Wolfe said that there must be a realistic prospect of them being actually removed in a reasonable period. So if that period, if it became clear that you wouldn't be able to remove the person for 10 years, then you would have to release them. What is a real reasonable period is elastic. So our basic law, our statutory framework, is extremely, shall we say, permissive of detention. And that includes asylum seekers. There's no special rule for asylum seekers. British law doesn't distinguish between different groups. But you might think that asylum seekers would be treated in a more favourable way because they are a special group seeking humanitarian protection. Oops, I'm going backwards. Let's see if we can go forwards. Right. Now, although this power is extremely broad, the government for many years has adopted a policy about who to detain, principally because detention space is limited. You know, it's a sort of rationing policy. You know, who are we going to detain? Because we can't detain everyone because there's not enough spaces to do it. There are about 3,500-4,000 spaces. We did used to use prisons quite a lot. We still do for some people. But the policy now is not to use prisons. As prisons are sort of last resort, if you like. Principally, though, use detention centres. There aren't that many places, so they have to say, right, who are we going to prioritise? So they had these three main criteria. The first criteria was it's appropriate to effect removal of a person. And there is a suggestion in the policy that the removal must be imminent. So if you think this person hasn't got any more applications, they've got no more basis for staying, and you're going to be able to remove them quite soon, and there's an if there, which is it's not always that easy to remove people, even though they haven't got any applications outstanding, because countries don't always want to take people back. So that might be one basis. Second one, to establish a person's identity or basis of claim initially. So the beginning of the process, a person arrives at Heathrow Airport and says, I'm claiming asylum or something, and an officer has a power to detain them for a short period just to find out, you know, who are you, what's going on, what's the basic element of your case. And then finally, where there's a reason to believe that a person will fail to comply. So they'll run away, abscond. So those are the three sort of grounds in the policy for detaining someone. However, around the time of this new policy, 2001, they introduced a fourth ground, which is where a person is seen to be suitable for detention, who's claimed asylum, and that fast-track processes might be applied to their case. So there was this fourth ground, which was a special one for asylum seekers, who it looked like their case could be decided quickly. And that's still there in the policy. So you have a special category carved out there, which is interesting, because what it suggests is that asylum seekers might end up being treated worse than others. Not guaranteed. But if you're not an asylum seeker, then one of these other grounds has to apply to you to justify detention under the policy. Now, how binding is a policy? British public law, the courts have said that these policies are binding on the government. So that although the statutory framework is broad, if the government ties itself in handcuffs through a policy, it has to adhere to that policy, and if it doesn't, it's an unlawful detention usually. So the policy is more than just, you know, guidance. It becomes effectively law that the government can change, but whilst it's in force, they have to follow it. And then if you look further in the guidance, they say, they give some more information about when to use detention. Use sparingly, the shortest period necessary. Don't use it if they've got a long process of application that's going on, and that in the end you might remove them, but during the application you shouldn't keep them in detention pending processing. And then you're going to look at, they have to look at a number of factors. What's the likelihood that they're going to be removed? Does the individual, what are their expectations about the case? Are they optimistic, and therefore are they likely to keep in touch with you because they think they're going to win, or do they think their case is hopeless and therefore if you let them out they'd run away, they'd run a mile? So there are questions like this, interesting questions that the government has to try and understand to decide whether to detain. Have they got an outstanding appeal? Again, incentives to keep in touch. And then you look at their ties to the community. Are they an absconding risk? So this is the general grounds, excluding fast-track cases and criminal casework. So these are the criminal casework is the deportation cases. So in a normal case, an ordinary case, these are the kinds of things you'd consider. But if it's an asylum case, potentially, you won't look at those things. You won't really mind if they've got strong ties to the community, they won't run away. because those are excluded under the policy. Asylum cases that can be considered for fast tracking. So in Saudi, Grand Chamber, that back in 2002, in the days of Tony Blair, who was a prime minister who, when there was a problem, he would generally take things by the scruff of the neck. And he said, 2002, we had 84,000 asylum claims, far too many. It was becoming a political issue. So they set up a whole new processing system in a barracks, the Oakington Barracks. And it was very much an efficient system. They did 150 interviews a day, and they were processing many, many thousands of people every year. And the idea was that it would take 7 days to make a decision. There had been great delays up until that point. There was a backlog. Asylum claims were not being decided for many, many years. They were being lost in the system, you know, infamous sort of filing cabinets that no one could find, and so forth. It's very chaotic. So they said, well, no, we're going to get on top of this. We're not going to have any more delays. Decide. You arrive in this centre, and on the seventh day, you'll get a decision. You're allowed to move inside. It was a barracks, so sort of military-style freedom, should we say. You're allowed to move around inside the perimeter, and there was quite a big range of facilities. There were lawyers there on site that were free. There were places of worship, sports, and so forth, different facilities. So it was considered a relaxed and fairly a helpful institution in terms of people being able to put their claim together. Although 7 days wasn't very quick, I mean, it's not very long. The idea was that if you had a lawyer there to help you early on, you might be able to put a claim together prior to the decision. Who was going to be sent there? Anyone for whom there was going to be a quick decision. And it was certain nationalities, particularly ones where they thought there was no general risk of persecution. So places perhaps where it was going to be pretty easy for the government to make a decision, and generally one that would be negative. The strange thing was that after the policy was that once you were refused, you were released. The policy was to refuse, not the policy was to refuse, probably make a decision on the seventh day and then release someone. So the rather than detain someone throughout the process, including the appeal, because there is a right to appeal against the refusal, the policy is released on the seventh day. So what happened to Mr. Saadi? He arrived at the airport, he claimed asylum, and he was released temporarily for two or three nights, and he kept reporting to the police, and he showed that he was not going to run away. And then on the third day, they said, right, aha, we've got this lovely place for you called Oakington, we're going to send you there, and we're going to process your claim. And they processed the claim. On the seventh day, they refused him, and then they released him. And he complained to the European Court of Human Rights, saying that was arbitrary detention because I wasn't trying to run away. I was trying to present my claim, and I didn't show any signs of wanting to hide. I was coming forward. I was making an application to enter as an asylum seeker. And the government said, well, we accept all that, but we had this unprecedented number. We needed to set up a special system. So they went to the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court said, interestingly, that the government was justified in detaining just to process his claim, not because he was going to run away, not because he wasn't cooperating, but just because it was more efficient for the government to detain people in this way, because they could have all the interpreters there, they could have all the officers there, they could have this very efficient place that would mean that they could process large numbers of claims. And the court said that it doesn't need to be the case that detention is necessary to prevent illegal entry. So the way, the convention says in Article 5.1F, it says you can detain someone to prevent their unlawful entry or pending their deportation. And his argument says, well, I'm not trying to enter unlawfully. I'm trying to enter lawfully. I've arrived at the airport, I've claimed asylum, and I'd like to be, I'm waiting for a decision. Yeah. The European Court said, although Article 5.1F says it has to be to prevent unlawful entry, your detention is only justified if it is to prevent unlawful detention, actually, it doesn't quite mean that. What it means is the government does have a power to detain for a period even someone who is presenting themselves quite regularly, not sneaking in the middle of the night in a ship, you know, under cover of darkness, clambering up the beach and running away, but someone who arrives at the airport and is quite regular. So the court said, as long as it's done in good faith, it's closely connected to a legitimate aim, and it's proportionate, i.e. the government's facing a difficult situation, it needs to set up a special processing regime, and that processing regime is not too harsh. So the place and the conditions of detention were reasonable. The government was justified. But Judge Bratzer, he agreed, but he said anything beyond 7 days would be arbitrary. It would be too much just to detain someone for longer than 7 days as an administrative measure, just because you were processing their claim, would have been too much. So that was what Saadi said. The government, following that, introduced some developments, shall we say. The first one was a so-called super. I think it was probably a sort of a colloquialism, the super fast track, which basically involved a new detention centre at Harmondsworth, and included an expedited appeal. So it wasn't just the application, but they set up a special court with its own set of rules. And the idea was that that court could deal with appeals very quickly. Before that, the courts were taking many, many months to hear an appeal, and you couldn't really detain someone during that period. It was too long. So they set up some sort of procedural rules to allow a court to sort of bolt on to the initial application process. But the minister said, a succession of ministers said to Parliament, this doesn't mean that we're going to detain everyone as soon as their claim is refused. Because obviously that would mean a lot longer period of detention, from 7 days. Could mean many, many weeks. So they said, once we've refused your claim, we will still apply the standard criteria that I set out at the beginning, i.e. are you going to run away? Is your removal going to be imminent? Those kind of things. They expanded it to include women at the Earlswood Centre in 2005. And then it's only 2008. There's some kind of possible shift, although it's still not 100% clear that it did happen. It's being discussed at the moment in a case that's being brought against the government. That at that point, there seemed to be a move towards detaining even past the decision stage. So after 7 days, you get the decision, but then the policy is to carry on detaining, even during an appeal, which obviously under Saadi wasn't the case. Under Saadi, you were supposed to be released after 7 days. So, 2013, there's this case, detention action against the government. It hasn't yet been decided. The case has been heard, and apparently the judge has been thinking about it for 6 months. And we don't know what's going to decide, but during that case, the government was asked, well, has the policy changed from 2003, when the ministers were saying to Parliament, we won't detain beyond the initial decision, i.e. 7 days. Saadi, 7 days. The government apparently said in various affidavits, well, it was always our policy to detain, right throughout the process, through the appeal as well. And furthermore, that at a certain date around this period, the list of countries was taken away so that anyone could be put through this the fast track. There wasn't a special list of countries where it looked like your case was going to be easy. General principle then was that presumption that you could be put through the fast track. So the current policy then, as it's set out in the guidelines, is that anyone who claims asylum is in principle someone who can be put through the detained fast track. There's no nationality restriction anymore. So even countries where it's acknowledged there are quite widespread problems, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, those kind of countries, applicants from those countries in principle can go through this process. I put RAG criteria, they red, amber, green, RAG, red, amber, green. Apparently they will exclude some people where they find it very, very difficult to remove them because of the documentation. But in principle, anyone could be put through it. They have to decide, can they make a quick decision? So are there problems about processing the claim that make it complex? You might need to get some extra documents, translations, and so forth. Also, does a person fall into a sort of vulnerable group, in which case they might be excluded? The principles in terms of time have been maintained since the Harmansworth. In Harmansworth, what they decided was, in the super fast track, that they were going to move to a decision on day three. So you'd arrive on day one, you would have a decision by day three. Currently, that's still the goal, but in practice, that decision's not till 7 to 14 days. Seems to be taking quite a bit longer. There is this policy of flexibility. So if a lawyer says, my case is too complicated, please don't put it in fast track, they can remove it. So that's there. And that was important because the Court of Appeal in 2004 was asked to find that the whole fast track was too fast. It was so fast it couldn't be fair. And the Court of Appeal said, no, there is this flexibility. As long as it's clear that they use that, then it's okay. The independent chief inspector did a sort of audit of fast track cases, and he found that interviews was day 11, was the time when someone had an interview. So they'd been in detention for 11 days before interview. Interestingly, they only see the lawyer on that day, the day before, because the way the lawyers work now is they're not in the site. They're brought in, and the government appoints a lawyer effectively for the person on the morning of the interview. So there's quite a long period of administrative detention that is not explained. Get a decision after nearly 2 weeks. That was in his sample. And then the appeal is finally received on day 29, and then removal day 89. And that was 56 cases were removed. So 89 turns out to be closer to 3 months of detention before you're actually removed. and of that, and that's for only 56 were actually removed. So you can see there that we're getting into periods that are quite a bit beyond the Saadi guideline. And the reasons that are given to the detainees, they're given a sheet of paper to explain why they're detained. And these reasons all are the familiar ones, that you might run away. But then it says, and in these fast-track cases, it always says, I'm satisfied your application may be decided quickly. And then when you go on to look at the next sheet of paper, which explains the reasons for the reasons, if you like, you don't have enough close ties, it repeats this thing. It just says, on initial consideration, it appears your application may be one decided quickly. So that's the paperwork that's given to people, because under Article 5.2, you have to give reasons for detention. And so you can see there, there's no further reason. It's just that we think we can deal with this quickly. The policy is ambiguous on whether it applies in every case to the post-decision period. So once you've had your decision, what should happen then? Should they reconsider whether to carry on detaining you during the appeal, or should they just do that automatically? The policy is a little bit ambiguous. The policy seems to suggest in certain places that the detention will continue as a matter of course once you've had a refusal, which again is different to Saadi. Remember, in the Saadi policy, the Court of Human Rights was told they're released at the end of the decision process unless there's a new reason to detain, i.e. they'll run away or something. The current policy says if an individual's application is unsuccessful and they become appeal rights exhausted, detention may continue under general detention policy. So it seems to be implying that they are thinking that the detention would continue beyond into the appeal until the appeal rights are exhausted. It's not absolutely explicit, because the policy sort of flips between talking about an application and an appeal. Obviously, there are two different stages. Saadi was all about the application, not the appeal. The tribunal has some quite tight time limits to decide the appeal, but in the end, this period, when you add the application and the appeal, is going to be about 5 weeks. So it is five times the Saadi period. So if we look to summarise, then what we can say is that in terms of comparing now to Saadi, 2013, 20,000 applications, so a quarter of the applications back in the day of Saadi, they are removal centres now. It's not Oakington's been closed. It was closed in 2010. So they're removal, they're closed centres now. It's not the same physical environment that Saadi looked at. It's not the relaxed regime, it's more closed. I mean, they're not prisons, but they are more confining. 2,000 people were put through detained fast-track processes, so about 10%. It's hard to know now how that 10% are picked out. What we do know is that anyone is eligible. Any country, any male, female. The only thing is that it looks like probably the spaces are limited. There's probably not that many spaces available on any given day. So it probably is just operational constraints rather than anything else that determines whether you end up in this. When Oakington was closed, they had 366 people, and they had 150 had been detained for more than a month. So even looking at Oakington back then, the detention periods were quite a bit longer than the 7 days. And if we look at the periods, as I said earlier, when the interview is taking place, it's taking place, you know, after a couple of weeks in some cases. And the lawyer is only seeing the person on that day. So this period before the interview is not a period in which the application is being prepared, if you like, and is being used for that purpose. Yeah. And basically, the question then is, what is going on here in terms of the policy? Is there a policy to detain in all cases after the decision? And that would be different to what the European Court allowed in Saadi. Would it be proportionate because of some pressing need? Well, the applications are quite a bit lower, so the proportionality looks a little different now than it did then. If you look at fairness as well, there's the detention issue, but then there's the fairness issue. If you look at fast-track refusal, there's about 99% refusal rate. Compared to non-fast-track, 74%. And then the same on appeal, 93% in the fast-track. I think it's perhaps close to 90 now, but it's a very high rate of dismissal compared to 69 in the non-fast track. So putting through people through a fast track statistically means you're more likely to lose both the application and the appeal. And if there's no whitelist anymore, if any country can be put through fast track, then there are questions about fairness of that process, because what it's saying is, well, why is there such a big difference? It's not the country profile that would explain that. It could be the fact that if your case is in the fast track, it's a lot harder to prepare it. You don't see your rep until the day of the hearing, of the day of the interview, and your communication is quite restricted, even in preparation for the appeal. So, question then, what is the policy on detention now? What has it been since 2008? It's quite interesting that it's only this last year that a case has actually been brought to consider what has been going on. Does it comply with Saadi? And why hasn't it been brought? I think probably because most of the attention of detainees is on winning their case. If they can get a good lawyer, the lawyer tries to win the appeal and doesn't worry about detention too much. Or they'll try and get it removed from fast track, which can be done. You can ask the Home Office or the court to reassign it. But to challenge the actual legality of detention in fast track is a bit time consuming, a bit awkward. Perhaps you've got more pressing things on your mind. For NGOs too, there is a sense that they've been looking at the very long periods of detention as the more pressing issue. You know, what about a person who's been detained a year, 2 years, 3 years, rather than relatively short periods at the asylum stage? You know, well, what's the difference between a week and 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks? Those are all relatively short periods. What I'm saying is, well, that may be so, but Saadi, the decision in Saadi, was quite carefully crafted to deal with the policy of the government as it was then. And it's interesting, it seems to be changing, or has changed, to be rather more broad in terms of time for detention, and it now seems to encompass the appeal period. So the question is whether the Saadi principles are really being followed any longer. And it's interesting in terms of the rule of law. Detention should be based on a clear policy. But as I've illustrated, the policy is quite opaque, quite ambiguous. What is the policy? Is it to detain for 7 days and then release? It doesn't look like that any longer. It looks like there's a policy to detain for a period preparing an interview and then to carry on detaining through an appeal, which in the end, all that process could take, let's say, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, which is quite a different policy to the Saudi one. So it will be interesting to see what the case, the detention action case, says, because even establishing what the policy is has actually proved quite challenging.
Good afternoon, and it's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here and to have the opportunity to present my work somewhere so prestigious. So I would like to thank Daniel Wiltshire for inviting me to be part of this seminar. Well, today my presentation will focus on a striking case of arbitrary detention on the southern borders of Europe. And in particular, I will talk about the immigration reception center on the Italian island of Lampedusa. My investigation started in 2011 while doing some fieldwork research conducted in the aftermath of the Arab Spring when I was authorized by the Minister of Interior to carry out monitoring activities on asylum seekers and migrants held hosted at the reception center of Lampedusa. Well, on that occasion, I personally observed the practice of unlawful deprivation of liberty perpetrated by border authorities to both asylum seekers and migrants who had disembarked on Lampedusa shores, where under the label of reception, foreigners are in reality subjected to real detention. I think that for a better understanding of the practices in Lampedusa, it would be helpful to make a premise on the general system of immigration centers in Italy. So, as you can see, there are three types of immigration centers according to the different functions they have in Italian immigration and asylum policy. First, the CIE centers. This is the acronym for Centri di Identificazione ed Espulsione, which means identification and expulsion and removal centers. And these centers are regulated by legislative decree number 286 of 1998. This decree is called Unified Text on Immigration. And this decree, which is the main Italian law in this field, has been recently modified in order to meet the provisions set by Return Directive of 2008. So these centers are enclosed facilities where foreigners whose expulsion orders cannot be immediately enforced are confined under police surveillance. People wait to be identified and eventually deported. In this system, a judge has to validate or dismiss the detention order within the next 48 hours when circumstances justify sub-detention according to the law. If no validation occurs within the said deadline, the order has no further effect and the foreigner must be released from CIE center. So this detention can last up to a maximum of 18 months under a system of judicial validation, and it is subjected to periodical judicial review. Second type is the CARA, which means Centri di Accoglienza per Richiedenti Asilo, which are reception centers for asylum seekers. Well, these centers house asylum seekers after their application for protection and pending its outcome in a non-detentive regime. That's very important because they have an humanitarian vocation. So these centers are are regulated by legislative decree number 25 of 2008, and they are open facilities. So Finally, we have CSPA centers. They are fast aid and reception centers, in Italian, centri di primo soccorso e di accoglienza. And they are pre-admittance facilities, and they are established by law, Apulia law, and regulated by a presidential decree. They are transit point where people who are found in border zones are hosted for a very short period in order to provide their assistance. So people are brought in these centers before the definition of their legal status. So after this period, except in cases in which authorities immediately carry out the refoulement of migrants, foreigners who are qualified as a regular migrant are in most cases relocated to CIE centers, and those who are instead qualified as potential asylum seekers are transferred to the CHRA centers for the identification in order to provide to the full examination of their application. Well, the center of Lampedusa belongs to the latter category of first aid and reception center, and let's now describe more in detail the situation. Well, I think you already know, Lampedusa is a tiny Italian island in the Mediterranean Sea, and as you can see looking at the map, it is closer to Africa than to Italy. Here thousands of migrants and asylum seekers arrive by boats each year. Over 25,000 persons have already landed during this year, and unfortunately, as you know, too often tragedies occur off its shores. So in Italy, media attention and, as a consequence, public opinion is always more heightened during the critical moments of disembarkation. But there is very little information on what happens after the landing on Italian shores. So I started my research on this premise, and my question was, what happens when migrants and refugees disembark on Lampedusa shores and are brought to the CSPA center, so before the definition of their legal status, and what is, in particular, the judicial regime on personal liberty in this pre-admittance period? Well, as all first aid and reception center, the center of Lampedusa was established to provide assistance and primary care, completed in a strictly necessary time limit, says the decree, but an exact term is not defined. So law and decrees have failed to specify terms and conditions of host's personal liberty, even though they do not take into account the possibility of detention. So as a consequence of a very laconic legislation, the pre-admittance period has been always regulated by discretion and practices of border police. Well, despite of its legal nature, the center of Lampedusa is definitely a detention center. This has been confirmed by my personal experience within the center, but also by several official reports issued, for example, by the Special Commission for Protection and Promotion of Human Rights of the Italian Parliamentary, or by the ad hoc committee of the Parliamentary Assembly of European Council. And in fact, I have to confirm that the facility is surrounded by walls and barbed wire, guarded by military and police forces. So within the center, asylum seekers and migrants are confined in subsections known as the cages, and surrounded by a 3-meter gate, round-the-clock control by military presence. So people cannot leave the subsections as well as leave the property. And moreover, who evades or try to evade the facility is caught and brought back to the center by means of force. So the length of stay in such deprivation of liberty is highly variable because there are some people who remain for a few days, I mean 4 or 5 days, but some of them even spend several weeks and sometimes months there before being repatriated or transferred to other centers on the mainland. And in this case, discretion of authorities prevails, and the choice of the duration of the deprivation of liberty and the permanence in the center may depend on many factors. It may depend on the difficulties in organizing a transfer to the mainland. It may depend on the number of landings, or it may depend also from on the relationship between Italy and third countries. I mean, if there are bilateral agreements or not, and so on. So, in all cases, asylum seekers and migrants are held, we can say, on the decision of border police authorities, and they are not issued with a detention order during their stay on Lampedusa. Moreover, right, they receive no official information about the reasons of their detention, and above all, they absolutely do not know anything about the duration of the deprivation of liberty. So, in my opinion, the above situation represents a case of unlawful detention in the light of the current Italian legal framework. And now I will try to explain my statement. Well, on one hand, the Italian Constitution states that every restriction of personal liberty should have a specific legal basis and should comply with judicial control. So, in fact, as you can see, according to Article 13 of the Italian Constitution, every type of deprivation of liberty, also in cases of necessity and urgency, must respect the principle of legality. We call this principle riserva di legge, and the principle of the right to judicial review. We call this principle riserva di giurisdizione. And the deprivation of freedom has to be strictly defined by the law, and it must be communicated to the judicial authorities within 48 hours. And should such measures not be confirmed by the judicial authorities within the next 48 hours, they are revocated and become null and void. So, on the other hand, as already mentioned, the Italian law states that CSPA, I mean first aid and reception centers, have a humanitarian vocation, and it does not provide any legal basis for detention. So the very same law does not mention the need to provide any judicial control, because detention is not the purpose of this kind of center. In fact, immigration detention shall take place only within the CIE's centers, which are specifically designed for that purpose by Unified Acts on Immigration. Hence, the deprivation of liberty perpetrated in Lampedusa does not respect both principle, legality, and judicial control. Well, in the light of the described situation, a question arises. I think immediately. Why, despite this unlawful situation, does a case law on Lampedusa issue not exist? Well, the answer is the total lack of legal remedies in order to challenge this situation in the Italian legal system and also some material condition. In particular, the main point that we have to consider, the first point is the physical condition of isolation within the center and the strictly limited access to lawyers. So those who are held in the center of Lampedusa have no contact with lawyers and do not receive any information about their rights to defense. Second, there is not a formal decision issued by administrative authority. So, as I have already said, foreigners are not issued with a real detention order in Lampedusa, and only after their transfer to the mainland, I mean to other centers on the mainland, irregular migrants are issued with a detention order and are brought before a judge for its judicial control. And finally, the lack of the lack in the Italian system of a general remedy of habeas corpus for the violations of Article 13 of the Italian Constitution. I mean, our system does not know the institution of habeas corpus. And in the absence of domestic judicial control, I think that the European Court of Human Rights represents an alternative, an additional possibility in order to challenge this kind of deprivation of liberty. And to this aim, we have to consider first Article 5 of the European Convention of Human Rights. So, well, according to Article 5, paragraph 1 of the Convention, any deprivation of liberty has to comply with two requirements. On the one hand, it must the deprivation of liberty must fall within one of the exceptions. Set out in subparagraphs A to F, and in the case of Lampedusa, the detention is justified by the case described by letter F, so the lawful arrest or detention of a person to prevent his effecting an authorized entry. On the other hand, the deprivation of liberty has to be lawful and implemented in accordance with a procedure prescribed by law. And according to Strasbourg case law, this last requirement refer primarily to procedural and substantive rules of national law. And as we have seen before, the deprivation of liberty in Lampedusa does not have a legal basis in the Italian legal framework, in the Italian context. So, in fact, the Italian Constitution, the Italian Constitution and the Unified Text on Immigration request that immigration detention shall take place only within CIE's centers and that a judicial review after the first 96 hours of deprivation of liberty takes place. So, moreover, we can find further violation in the context of Article 2 and Article 5, paragraph 2, and Article 5, paragraph 4 of the European Convention of Human Rights. In fact, in breach of Article 5, paragraph 2, people held in Lampedusa receive no information about the reasons of their detention and its duration, And as we have already seen in breach of Article 5, Paragraph 4, people held in Lampedusa as have no real chance to challenge their condition before a judge while they remain on the island. So also focusing on the procedural safeguards according to Strasbourg case law, we can affirm that the deprivation of liberty in Lampedusa does not respect the principles of Article 13 of the Italian Constitution and as well the principle of European Court of Human Rights case law in the context of Article 5, Paragraph 2 and 4. Well, I need very few words to conclude my presentation, if there is time. And I need to say that from the juridical point of view, I can say that despite of the existence in Italy of a specific legislation on immigration detention, Italian border authorities have subjected people who disembarked on the island of Lampedusa to unlawful detention in recent years. And this and the reception center of Lampedusa, at the reception center in Lampedusa, personal freedom rights are guaranteed by the Italian Constitution as well by the European Convention of Human Rights are being systematically violated. Fortunately, an appeal is currently pending before the European Court of Human Rights, and I really hope that Strasbourg judges will decide on this issue clearly and sharply, I hope so. But I have also to say that regarding immigration, the juridical point of view, the judicial point of view, is strictly connected with the political one. And in Italy, the management of border controls and immigration reception is based, unfortunately, on a state of permanent emergency. So Italy has largely failed to implement a long-term approach. And indeed, the authorities has often resorted to emergency plans that not guarantee consistent and adequate standards of rights and treatment. So due time constraints, we don't have time to examine the supposed violation of Article 3 of the Convention, but very briefly it should be pointed out how the continuing overcrowding and the total unsuitability of the facility, and I mean the deep psychological distress and poor hygiene conditions and so on results in inhuman condition and degrading treatment. Well, I'm concluding, and in my opinion, the reception and humanitarian assistance can never compensate for the lack of rule of law, and no administrative difficulties in the reception system can justify such violations of fundamental rights, because when fundamental rights are systematically violated, the problem is political, but is also maybe primary juridical. It's a legal issue, I mean. And what was happened in recent years in Lampedusa, such a striking violation of the guarantees of the rule of law, should not happen in Europe, even on the distant island of Lampedusa, I think.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Studies Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/connect.